Welcome to AZMCast, a peer-reviewed, evidence-based podcast heavily seasoned with expert opinion. For all you new listeners, I'm going to give you a quick tutorial on how to use this podcast to its fullest potential. For you faithful veterans, you can go ahead and skip ahead to the good stuff. As you listen to this podcast, you'll hear contributors give opinions on everything from practice styles to diagnostic evaluations to emergency medicine philosophy. When you hear the bell ding, that means that the opinion is backed by evidence. Check your screen on your device to see the reference paper, and we suggest taking a screenshot for future reading. When you hear the turkey gobble, that's just our opinion, and you can decide whether you want to take it or leave it. Happy December, everybody, and really, Happy New Year by the time you get to listen to this. Recently, I had the pleasure of sitting down with Dr. Joseph Kalonzi from Uganda and Dr. Brad Dreyfus from, well, Tucson, to talk about international emergency care from the perspective of those who live there. It was really a fascinating conversation about building an emergency medicine system from the ground up. Issues that have been dealt with decades ago in the U.S. healthcare system are now being addressed in Uganda, but can't necessarily be directly applied to a very different environment. Similarly, our offers to help may or may not be in line with the needs of the country in question. So, using Dr. Kalonzi's personal experiences as a backdrop, we're going to discuss the issues faced in emergency care by developing countries and how you can make certain that you're a help and not a hindrance when you arrive. It was all around an enlightening and sobering and really interesting conversation that I hope you enjoy as we ring in the new year. And in case you're wondering, no, I do not have a cold. I screamed my head off last night at the U of A ASU game, to which Arizona State lost by 6. Bear down and fear no fork. We're joined this month by global health experts. We've got Dr. Brad Dreyfus, who is an assistant professor of emergency medicine here at the University of Arizona and is also a collaborator with Global Emergency Care, the GEC. We also have Joseph Kalonzi, who is working with the university at Makere in establishing an emergency medical service and system. He's a consultant of the Ministry of Health. And they've both come here to talk about global emergency care and essentially international medicine. There is a lot of people in emergency medicine that feel that this is a specialty that just exudes being able to go out and practice anywhere they want. We certainly feel that in emergency medicine, we can take care of everything. But I've asked them to come and talk to us about not only how can we do a lot of what we're trained to do, but how can we do the most good with what we have. So, gentlemen, thank you very much for coming here. You guys were here for a summit to kind of talk about forming these systems. Can you speak a little bit about what you're both here for?
Sure. First of all, thanks very much for having us. It's pretty exciting to kind of be at a point where we can talk about development of services and how to support our colleagues abroad in developing systems that are more effective for their needs, not just based on what our experiences are. So we're working in true partnership. So the Eller School for Business has put together a social impact summit as part of the 10 West Festival that Tucson's been having the past 3 years. And we were asked to put together a panel specifically linking some of the concepts with entrepreneurism and health and capacity development. So Dr. Kalonzi was one of our panelists in conjunction with some entrepreneurs and some faculty from one of the universities in Uganda, really focusing on developing social entrepreneurism as a way to fund capacity development. healthcare and public health were a focus for that. So we're really lucky to have Dr. Clancy here.
All right, thank you for having me. And I'd like to say it's a pleasure to be here and contribute towards the global care as well as emergency care specifically, and actually share the story of a country developing an emergency care system in partnership with countries that have already established this system. So it's good to be here.
I wanted to ask both of you just kind of a bit about your backgrounds and how you came to this point. So, Brad, if I could ask you a little bit about global emergency care and just kind of what the organization is, what the goal of the organization is, and just kind of how it facilitates some of the things that you guys do.
Yep. So Global Emergency Care was started by five emergency physicians really early in their career, after one of them serendipitously ended up on a fourth-year resident rotation in a small rural hospital in Uganda where people were dying and having really bad morbidity, and he felt it could be prevented with some very simple basic interventions. And so in a place where the triage is happening by a guard, an untrained guard with an AK-47, and to evolving to a place where there's actually an emergency department and now trained providers, non-physician specialists. All of our backgrounds, I think, included a public health focus and really most of us trying to figure out how to make an impact with what emergency care education we've gotten in the States and how to leverage that to the benefit of our friends and colleagues abroad. The vision for global emergency care, which started in 2008, is that we envision a time when no life is limited to easily treatable illness or injury. And the mission is to make life-saving medical care available to all Ugandans. And so doing so, we found very quickly that we had to be working within the context of not just the countryside in Uganda, but where Uganda and the administrative aspects of Uganda within the Ministry of Health and the physicians and wanted to actually take things. Like, what did they conceive of as emergency care to start with? And not just be thinking about what we as a bunch of Westerners sitting in a rural part of the country thought was most appropriate. And that's where I think Dr. Clancy and my relationship really started in 2012.
Yeah, so we bumped into Bradley somewhere on the way to a conference in Ghana. We were going to attend the African Conference on Emergency Medicine. And so we bumped into each other and started talking about emergency care. And here I am today. And as Brad has mentioned a lot, Uganda is in the process of actually trying to create, out of an existing healthcare system, a niche for emergency care. So we already do provide emergency care, just that it hasn't been defined as emergency care. So a lot of the work we're doing now is to create a definition and a place for emergency care delivery in the existing system. Of course, we're already on the back foot because countries from LMIC countries, low and middle income countries, already underfund healthcare. For example, in Uganda, the budget for health services is less than 10% of the national budget. And so we're already on the back foot trying to carve out a special service out of an already underfunded sector is a very complicated thing. And so our work here is to carefully create something in the awareness that it's not necessarily going to be up to the scale of a developed country, and of course, which brings in a lot of humility in that we have to accept that what we're developing is going to have to meet the needs as well as use the resources that are already existing. So it puts us in a very unique situation, and I think it provides an excellent opportunity for people who want to observe the genesis of an emergency care system in the modern age, right? You have a reference to about 40 years ago. We are current reference in that it's being done right now, but with the privilege of knowing how it can get better in the reality of what is currently existing. So I think that brings to the table an excellent opportunity for people to learn about a system, not in as far as the silos that we know of emergency emergency medicine, pre-hospital EMS, disaster medicine, but emergency care as a whole. So I think that is a great opportunity, and I believe some of your listeners might be interested in such an experience. Just that we have to realize that we're all learning. It's a learning experience for all of us. So
literally building the plane as we're flying it. And I think it's important to really call out that there's the opportunity to observe, but there's also the ability, and I think imperative, to leverage our privilege. Our privilege of position, of being able to study in the United States and be able to take our knowledge and be able to help translate that in the socially, culturally appropriate way that's actually dictated by our colleagues, our Ugandan colleagues, having them articulate to us what's helpful at certain junctures instead of us coming in with all of our wily good ideas and large amounts of funding, which sometimes happens. So literally letting it happen in an organic way.
I think it's interesting just as you describe this, of having to define emergency care. I mean, emergencies happen, whether they're defined, whether they're paid for, whether they're expected or not, they're going to happen. So just even the idea of having to define emergency care, I think to a lot of us is a bit baffling. If you had any of us, I think, have to start with where you're at right now of having to define this, I don't think any of us would be able to start up a system, but we're very accustomed to the system that we have. So in doing this, I'm curious, what are some of the models that maybe you've tried to adapt from in order to create an emergency system, or is this really nothing's applicable and you're having to start from the ground up?
That's an excellent question, and actually I'd like to reiterate what you just mentioned. Emergencies do occur whether or not there are systems in place to handle them, and that's a quote by one of my mentors, Brad's mentor, Dr. Olive Kobusinje, a Ugandan surgeon who actually helped establish the foundations of trauma and emergency care. So she already was describing these things, even though they were not defined in Uganda, but she was setting the playing field. And so this is a reality. We do face emergencies, and at a point when you are trying to create systems, there are certain requirements for you to integrate what you are proposing into the existing statutes. So for my work, I've been privileged to work with the Department of Health. In Uganda, it's called the Ministry of Health. And the Ministry of Health, the service delivery is decentralized, and we have policies and guidelines that guide on how it's delivered. So for emergency care to be incorporated into the system, we have to define it within the language that exists. And so to define it, we were of course looking at the broader Anglo models, or the American models, or the Francophone models, which have different approaches completely. Yes.
Polar opposites.
Yes, polar opposites. So we are faced with this, and then, for example, I was looking at different. So my first 2 years at the Ministry of Health were in developing ambulance services. So I was creating structures for EMS, and so for the Francophone model, it's what you call stay and treat, or SAMUR, in which there's the privilege of having highly trained specialists going out to the field and treating. And that looked nice. I said, maybe that should be good. And then I looked at the American one, where you have existing ambulances, you have fire stations that have infrastructure, and that also looked nice. But then I said, but there must be a reason why they are different models. So I dug deeper and I looked at the finance behind each of these systems. For the systems that exist on the models, they're established in systems where there's actually a lot. There's this, the financial models are very well established. We need to deliver emergency care as one of the components of the health services in that context. And so a lot had to change. So it had to bring us down to the basics. Define exactly what it is you're trying to introduce to the smallest detail, and then see whether or not it fits within the existing infrastructures, and then just define it. create clear ways in which from the existing pie you can actually use this. This was a model that was, of course, very complicated for most of our development partners, because they say, how are you going to fund this? How are you going to fund this? How are you going to fund this initiative? But I say, no, we will use the existing structures, the existing funding streams to just leverage. We'll leverage from the existing funding streams. But it was difficult for development partners. They said, but you need to fund. In our country, the word fund is not so common. So programs start and have to be ingrained within the system. And so creating that is not very easy. But we learn by the day. We learn by the day. I think Brad can give you experiences from GECC.
I think the starting point, I think, is interesting to really consider, because in the way the structures for health development has happened, and I think development in general, have been very siloed programs. Some vertical, we call them vertical programs. You have them for maternal child health, you have for HIV, you'll have for trauma, you'll have for deworming programs, malnutrition. They're all siloed. And so trying to understand how to really frame emergency care as what it is a horizontal program that is supportive of all the others takes working to change the paradigm of those who you're trying to convince that emergency care is important, even though they know that their family members are suffering emergencies all the time and they want to have the best possible outcomes, or friends.
I'll take you just a bit back again when we get to the fundamentals of system development. The core components of a system that are fundamentally the pillars of a system. So this includes human resources, includes infrastructure, it includes governance, includes things like processes. And so those are the areas that need to be developed, right? So low and middle income countries for a long time were a dumping ground for things, stuff. People would say, oh, we're going to help Uganda develop emergency care, then they send us a bunch of ambulances. So as we did the last census, we saw we have in excess of about 300 ambulances across the country. That's a population of 40 million. You'd think if the measure of emergency care was ambulance, we're not doing so badly, yes? We're not doing badly. So they tried to look back and think, what is it we're trying to achieve? And it's delivery of emergency care to people when they need it, wherever they are, be it on the scene, in the household, on the road, and in the hospital. Right? And so when you look at it deeper, it's the ability of someone trained on lay to be able to give you care where along the spectrum you are. So the approach has shifted. Aside from it just being some very easy capital products to give, it actually is going to require a change in which, a shift in which we deliver care. Because the way care is delivered in our countries and realistically is siloed, as Brad mentioned. There's surgical care, obstetric and maternal care, pediatric care, infectious disease care. Right? In the recent past, a lot has been towards HIV, so a lot of funding has gone to HIV care. But emergency care is not siloed, it cuts across. So meaning everyone across the healthcare delivery platform has to be able to provide emergency care. So in my opinion, the actual investment area where the fund should be going is in empowering all healthcare providers with the ability to provide care. That's going to be the number one. And the reason why that is a sustainable method is we already have structures that ensure we train, we recruit, and employ. Such structures exist, just that the people there do not have the lenses to actually see what emergencies are.
I think it's important to really call out the fact that, and I feel like we take this for granted, is that emergency care is not a set of skills. It's not just being able to put in a central line, be able to put an ET tube if you're in a contextually appropriate place. It's not just suturing up wounds. It's not just having a certain base of knowledge. it's really a way with that you look at a patient or look at a situation. It's a lens with which you look at the world and how you integrate all of those pieces within a system that has developed or is developing and will be evolving. Having different levels of care, thinking about physician level or non-physician specialist, or whether it be pre-hospital, like paramedical, or whether it be lay provider, like first responders that we have. Within a whole system, it needs to be developed, and that's what Dr. Clancy is working on for the whole system.
So for example, we did a quick census survey, and we realized that only less than 4% of people who go to a hospital arrive by ambulance. 4%, and that's a rise. So before 2010, there was less than 2%. But they do arrive. Clearly, someone is taking them to the hospital, and we do have very excellent figures. Our outcomes are quite good at the continent in terms of maternal and child health. So care is actually being given, just that it's not defined. So in terms of what the approach is going to be, it's not going to be the conventional. We have an emergency medicine program that trains physicians, with an output of 5 physicians every year. That's not the solution. Mm-hmm. It's going to be a system issue. For example, we have in our country less than 10 neurosurgeons. 10. For a country of 40 million. They do provide the care. Yeah. So the approach is going to have to change drastically, because care is going to be given. We just have to find a way in which we define our global definition of emergency care within the Ugandan or the developing context, the developing country context. So it's up to us who have had the privilege of seeing it in its generic form to then reinvent it into what the developing countries are actually creating now.
Kind of a crude assessment of the needs, it seems, is there are capital needs, there are equipment needs, there are consumables, medications, and the like. There's certainly a personnel need. But in order to integrate all those, what's really needed is a system that incorporates all of these so that they can work cohesively, they can work efficiently, and actually provide what's needed. So it's not just a lump sum of funds. It's actually the knowledge of how and when it needs to be distributed or things need to be purchased so that you can adapt to the growing field that you have.
I agree with you entirely. That is a paradigm shift. I think we've already captured you, right? And you have agreed with what we're saying. So once
it didn't take much. makes pretty good sense.
Makes sense. Yes. So once I had during my time with the Department of Health, I was pushing for funding for emergency care, and then the top official said, "But we gave you 10 ambulances. Haven't you sorted out emergency care?" Right, that was his response. He says, "But I gave you 10 ambulances, did I not?" I said, "Yes. And I gave you fuel, right? So isn't emergency care for the next 20 years sorted out?" So it's those shifts, those fundamental shifts. But again, as we then at least get to the same footing, on the same table, and agree that this is what we're going to provide, then we now get down to the nitty gritty. Yes, the supplies, infrastructure, the human resource credentialing and training, and the final print.
And I would say this is where organizations like Global Emergency Care as a nonprofit come in, and that's after having developed the relationships with the partners and having our operations evolve to what they need, allows us to actually leverage not just our financial resources but our training programs to fit into this emerging global care system. And so it all comes with trial and error.
Right.
But what Global Emergency Care has found is the ability to to A, train non-physician specialists in emergency care, which is now being granted, they're now being granted diplomas as emergency care practitioners.
This is task shift.
Correct. This is task shifting, or you can call it task sharing, and where you have both, mm-hmm. right? There will be urban emergency departments or suburban emergency departments that have both emergency physician and a non-physician specialist, much like we have in the United States. But we're also able to then support the education systems for physicians, as well as help develop the research and leverage our research expertise, leverage our education expertise, as especially as academic emergency physicians in the states, and have that be directed by our colleagues, whether it be from the system levels with the committees headed by Dr. Kalanzi and Kokosinje and others, or whether it be at an individual hospital level where they're implementing an emergency care practitioner program to make sure that fits the needs of that specific hospital as directed by that specific medical superintendent and the stakeholders on the ground there. So there's multiple layers of stakeholders. And the reason why we've been successful as an organization is not only because we've been malleable, and I think we strive for walking with cultural humility and the willingness to actually have our mission dictated by our stakeholders, but that we're also able to bring in residents, fellow faculty members, and students, and leverage their time in an existing system, orient them to that this paradigm shift and where their place is in it and working with emergency care, and hopefully give them an outlet from which to really spark their interest further, give them opportunities for growth and education and research. And a lot of it comes down to relationship development with our practitioners and with our teams, because it's absolutely inspirational. And I'm not abashed about saying I am way more inspired by my Ugandan colleagues, whether they be the mid-level providers or whether they be Dr. Kalanzi and our colleagues, and what they're able to do, not just at the bedside, but also in their ability to think about systems and advocate for systems and put trust in this process that's developing. When we as Americans have it easy because our pathways are already illuminated, Dr. Kalanzi, I will call out as being completely faithful about this and not knowing what his career is going to look like, but knowing that it needs to be done and being the one willing to stand up and lead this with a group of Ugandan colleagues to actually make this happen. And that is ultimately inspiring and something that's kept pushing me. And I think when our other colleagues and students and residents see this and I see the capabilities, I think they will be inspired to leverage our privilege as well.
I think it's incredible. Like I said before, like if you had any of us sit down and say, write on a piece of paper what emergency care is, I don't think we could do it. But it's the conversation that you describe with the Ministry of Health official, it's just an incredible conversation to kind of wrap my brain around, because at least, you know, in our country, the Emergency Medicine Treatment and Labor Act says, mm-hmm. defines that people define their own emergency, and anyone who steps foot into our emergency department has decided they have an emergency. And so that's kind of what we're rallied around. So in trying to set up these definitions to describe to officials of people who are going to be funding and helping to implement these policies, in trying to come up with these definitions, what are the expectations in treatment for emergencies, and what are the patient's expectations when they come to the hospital?
That's an excellent question. Thank you very much. So the WHO created something called the WHO Emergency Care Framework. So it broadly defines three levels of emergency care. The scene care, transportation phase, as well as the facility-based care phase. So in providing care, we're looking at all those three levels, but then before we even now start to define them, we need to agree that there's a need to create or define what we're dealing with. What's our burden? So for many years, some courses were the definition of emergency care. So you were a doctor, and if you had been trained in two courses, which I might not necessarily name here, that one-day course on something, on resuscitation, and something, yeah, some very, very specific things, then you are you could provide emergency care. So for many years, we would have a certificate, which costs a lot of money, frame it properly, put it up on your wall, and then, yeah, then go ahead and do your normal work. So that was just something extra.
That is no different here. We are still having the debates over these merit badge courses. They shall remain nameless, but everyone knows when we call them merit badge courses what we're talking about.
So that's an issue we're still grappling with now. So we would have it and pin it up and then go and do your real medicine. So our definition of emergencies is very broad. We're a country where we've been struggling, where infectious disease is still a big problem. We're shifting again with the development, they come NCDs. So that's what they say. Paradigm is that developing countries suffer from infectious disease, developed countries have NCDs. So with our development, we're now adopting NCDs.
Can you define NCDs?
So non-communicable diseases. So the common ones is cardiac, hypertension, stroke, diabetes, obesity.
Diseases of prosperity.
Of prosperity, yeah.
I mean, and I think what... coming from the perspective of comparative health systems and global health, really it's being called the double burden of disease. You still have very prevalent infectious disease, which we don't have here, including malaria, HIV with prevalence much, much, much higher than ours. But you also have the diabetes and heart disease and emphysema and all these others. And injury, by the way, which is one of the fastest growing causes of morbidity and mortality, road traffic crashes.
Yeah, when you do mention injury, I remember I was I got a privilege to shadow at a hospital in the US, and they had resuscitation rooms, right? So resuscitation, there's resus 1, resus 4. And they said, these rooms are being kept here for the most critical patients. And there'll be an alarm, and then everyone would run in to save the day. So I waited to see these resuscitators that are coming in. So the alarm goes off, everyone runs. So I see for the first time, I've never seen a team of 10 people in one room around one bed looking after one patient. So I go in, I thought this man's head was decapitated, because that should be the only reason.
That's the easy case. You just call the coroner. That one's easy.
Yeah, so that's what I thought it was.
Those are pretty easy to treat.
Very easy. So that's what I thought we were going to deal with. And I find that he had, I think he that was a stroke. It was a stroke code. And he came in. I said, no, that's a. And then the other one came in with a partially amputated thumb. Mm-hmm. But there was a trauma surgeon, a trauma team, and then about four nurses, each of them doing something. And so I thought back to what my department, what my practice is. So on an average shift, there's three doctors. And this is the National Referral Hospital. Three doctors.
This is not the rural district hospital where we started.
It's the National Referral Hospital. This is the highest level hospital in the country. There's three doctors. And
three doctors in the emergency room.
This is in the emergency room. Because this is the National Referral
Hospital. What level of training do these doctors have?
The highest is a trauma surgeon, and then the other one is a surgeon, and then the other is a medical officer, so we call them generalists, and maybe two to three nurses on a good shift. That's the day shift. Then night shift is one doctor and one nurse.
How many beds?
We have about actual physical beds, 50. Then the actual patients on the ward are going to be 70.
I'm starting to sweat right now just thinking about that.
So this is a hospital that handles the major trauma. So in any 1 minute, we will have easily about 20 people that you categorize as critical major traumas. And so the context is different. And we have one nurse and two doctors or something. So the burden is different. But that's the trauma hospital. But in rural settings as well, we have a good mix, but more towards the infectious diseases. So some, just for the attention of partners who are coming to experience work both in the urban setting and rural, the case mix is very different. So in what you would have been equipped to handle your cardiac resuscitations, your trauma, you might maybe handle three cases like that in a rural hospital and handle 25 acute malaria, right? right? So for someone who has come with the expectation of handling something else, it's a bit of a shift. So I'm saying all this to show you that we are now at the phase where we're going to define what our emergency burden is. So with that definition of what along the spectrum of infectious disease all the way to the NCDs, malignancies, and things, then we define what needs to be given at those four, at those three levels, the scene care, transportation, as well as facility-based care. So that's where we are right now. We're trying to actually do a lot of research. Actually, so now is the time where a lot of study has to get going to actually helping us who are writing the policies to define what we're going to be dealing with.
I think it's important, especially for our listeners who may not have this context, to know that it's not just the spectrum of what you see, but it's the very huge spectrum of severity and how it's skewed much more to the extremely severely ill.
To the high acuity.
The exceptionally acute patient. Because people don't actually know about emergency care to the same degree. They might go to two or three, four other doctors or traditional healers first, or they might not have mobilized the resources.
In Uganda, health services are provided by the government. Right, so our health service provision is public sector and private sector. So the bulk of it is provided by government. So it's free, but because of shortages, again, as I said, budget limitations, many times there'll be stockouts, and so patients are requested to supplement the care by given the reality that this is what you actually need, but if you could go procure it at some wherever, you bring it, then it's going to help. So it doesn't necessarily mean that they go to the hospital requiring, yeah, because that has caused a lot of bad, left a bad taste in the health service to the assumption that that doctors and the health service is the doctors are misusing that we are misusing the facility, because governmental policy is if you walk into a public facility, you'll get care for free. Right, so a lot of discussion right now is on contributions, certain kinds of contributions. So it has to be formalized that patients in situations would be required to contribute towards their care. But the private sector does exist as well, where it is known that they walk in and there will be requirements to pay. So in providing this emergency care again and defining its role, we again have to use those exact frameworks. But as you know very well, emergencies don't have the time sensitive, right? And so we're trying to see a way in which we can harness some resources from a high-end level policy where we will almost either ring fence resources for the emergency area. Actually, right now what I've been tasked to do is to define what an emergency department is. So only four hospitals have emergency departments officially in the country. Yes, four hospitals by definition. So I now need to rearrange the wording and say an emergency department has to look like this. It should have this equipment, this set of supplies. So we're at the beginning. But that said, it's a complex scenario in that we're trying to show that emergency care is time sensitive both to limb and life, and therefore would require a certain escalated or higher status, just like how you have an ICU, right? To have certain leverage, to have access to supplies and equipment that other parts of the hospital might not necessarily get the privilege to. So we're still in those discussions. A lot of it is discussions with that.
So, you know, having talked about this, it's I think a lot of our listeners have either been overseas to try to do some international healthcare, or they listen to this and say, man, I really feel like I could help out with this. I've spent a couple weeks on a trip where we would hike a pharmacy into the mountains and treat patients in Guatemala. And I mean, I left feeling like, man, I did something very good. But in retrospect, a lot of what I did was acute care. It was things that aren't necessarily lasting. So in kind of preparing people for doing any kind of international medicine, if they're physicians, nurses, what have you here in the States, what are some of the characteristics of either an organization or a mission that provides something that's sustainable and actually more, you know, helpful to the scenario that you're in Uganda?
I think in regard to that, we're having this discussion with Dr. Dreyfus yesterday, and one is, I think in my opinion, it's the lens through which we see. So the awareness of Fatima emergency is, so for many, many, many years at the beginning of the HIV now pandemic, there were patients, people that suddenly were losing weight, were coughing, and would die all of a sudden. Yes, in Uganda we call this Silimu. It was coming from the word slim. It was called the slimming disease. So people died. We lost people in groves, in thousands of. And not until they discovered what the cause was did we curb this. So the same thing applies to emergency care. People are actually either getting very delayed diagnosis, delayed treatment, or mistreated and actually dying, mostly because we don't know that we're handling an emergency. And so, in my opinion, that's going to be the starting point, both from policy level, or that's high-level governance, to administration, and more importantly, to the clinicians. This is, includes the doctors, the mid-level providers, and nurses, showing them that there's this particular sort of field of medicine. It's a presentation of a patient that is emergent, that actually requires certain special skills. And so that, in my opinion, is going to be the initial hurdle. If we get as many people aware of it, for example, a lot of our we have people called village health teams, yeah, as well as traditional birth attendants. So these ones were taught that if a woman's abdomen was distended and she had absent menstrual periods and it was progressively distending, she was pregnant. And at some point, you'd have to deliver. And to deliver meant you'd have to deliver the baby, and then there'd be an afterbirth, and you deliver the two, you're done. And so they contribute. They find ways in which they know how to detect that there's a pregnancy. They know how to detect that labor has started. They know how to deliver second stage and third stage of labor in their context, mm-hmm. which we in some way find a way of standardizing. So the same thing is going to have to apply to emergency care in our country. If we get the paradigm shift that is required across the board, right? That's going to be the start. Right now, 80% of pre-hospital care to trauma victims of road traffic accidents is delivered by the police. But the care is not really care. It is basically transportation. I will not describe how they are transported, but they transport. So if you tell them, yes, you are transporting, but you can transport and consider hemorrhage control or immobilization, these are the basic principles. Go ahead, run with it. Then we'll, in some way, start to use existing resources.
I think a lot of what we're kind of getting at is from the frame or framework or lens of looking at what our colleagues and students are really wanting to be helpful and be useful. And I think that definition of helpful and useful has really changed. And I love that you shared your story about Guatemala, because I feel like a lot of students, a lot of residents, a lot of faculty have had and continue to have that sentinel experience where they feel like, oh, I really helped. And then they get home, they really think about what impact they might have had. And like, oh, I didn't really do anything. No. Oh, I could have actually used that $4,000 and donated that to an organization that is actually working on training and working with a Ministry of Health or working within the system. And so actually a lot of us who run small organizations who have been working with partners created a framework and actually wrote an article about this, because it's really hard to know. But actually articulating the necessary pieces to have in place, or the pieces to consider, would include: what's the local engagement by the organization? What's their awareness to and support of actually the local health system, or is what they're doing supplanting or alienating the local health providers? And what might that do to the long-term ability for that community to actually receive care? is the community that these visitors are being hosted in actually becoming dependent on those visitors in such a way that if there is A, a natural disaster, B, a conflict or some other tragedy, that that whole community's livelihood disappears and they're left indigent because they've shifted all of their time and personnel resources to support these visitors, right? And really looking at programs, whether they're one-offs or is there sustained or plans for sustained advancement? Is it based on just one grant, mm-hmm. or is there an infrastructure in which an organization has built to absorb volunteers as well as researchers as well as educators in a way that allows leveraging of that skill and privilege? And there are not many organizations like that. There's one, Global Emergency Care is one that, because of our positionality and because of the longevity of the relationship we've had 10 years in Uganda, we now have an understanding of how to do that more effectively and really maximize that time, money, and risk that people put in the line to come over. Mm-hmm. I'm all about transparency, and I think looking at transparency in your organization is also really important. And also, as faculty, us having the transparency in articulating the risk. Your biggest risk when traveling abroad is being in a road traffic crash. I think people being good consumers, and really there's some literature out there on how to be a good consumer for looking for organizations. I think for students, looking at CFHI, Family Health International, is one good place to look. But really, our universities are starting to realize that it's actually their responsibility to start building the infrastructure for students in ways that allows for them to have these experiences in a more equitable way. Instead of us foisting all of our students as volunteers and rotators and become a burden on another country or another group of stakeholders who have a hard enough time managing their own patients with three physicians in an emergency department, let alone having to watch over a visiting student who doesn't know what they're doing, doesn't know the language, etc. Really, universities building the infrastructure that enables young, eager faculty and mid-career faculty who have a mind for working with partners to actually do so in a safe way, in a supportive way, so these relationships can go on in perpetuity and these investments can actually have return on investment.
Just to add to that, again, if you look back at how essential surgical care was introduced, it was introduced into the system. So it was essential surgical care at the policy level. So there had to be some reflection of what essential surgical care was in the policies, in the direct service delivery. So there had to be a designated unit that provides the surgical care, which is the operating theater, and the one that stabilizes, which is the ward. Same thing with maternal care. Definitions as well as that, and then processes were geared and resources were allocated to those levels, right? Through which these are institutionalized. So all the care in developing countries is institutionalized. So government creates a budget and then funds you according to, then you appropriate the resources based on the levels, on the activities and functions that have been identified. So emergency care as well is going to take the same route. It's institutionalized. So there will be university programs that have emergency medicine as an academic program. There will be hospitals that have emergency departments as clinical areas, then the departments of health, for example, now in Uganda, we have a designated Department of Emergency Medical Services as of June 2017. So it was a restructuring of the entire structure of the Department of Health to incorporate a fifth directorate. So with
directorate?
Yeah, it's a department, but because I'm trying to make it in the context of the U.S. So now we have dedicated staff and all that. So they get budget and then they start organically planning for more, advocating for more resources and things like that. Then they get employed and then they're full-time staff. So in my opinion, the emphasis is going to be on developing partners plugging into those areas, mm-hmm. yes, as compared to coming in and creating coming in with a theater, if you know what I mean, coming with a bag of equipment and go in the middle of nowhere and say, do surgery for 10 people.
Sure.
Plug into the existing, go to the universities, go to the hospitals, go to the Ministry of Health, and they will give you the needs that they need at that point to be met.
And I think that's incredibly important, because there is something that having these experiences does to you as a person when you actually get to go see a completely different culture, a completely different way of life that you're not experienced to. I mean, it had a very profound effect on me. But I wonder, after spending 2 weeks treating intestinal parasites and draining abscesses and giving some albuterol for asthma exacerbations, after I left, these all came back. And so what lasting effect did I actually have on the people that helped me as much? And so I actually did. I started donating money to a group that had been down there so that they actually could do something sustainable. I mean, 2 weeks there was very impactful for me. And just with everyone has their calling and what they do, you can't necessarily say, well, I'm going to go live in Nepal for the rest of my life now because somebody has to do it. But there are people that's what you do. And if you can't, then I think you support those people.
I might also suggest, Dr. Leach, as a residency director, that your mentorship is going to be absolutely invaluable. Your input and your insight and the lessons learned and what have you for future residency directors, like I'm sure Dr. Clancy might end up being one day.
That's why we do these podcasts.
But honestly, like leveraging our ability to mentor, and you don't have to be there to mentor. We now have tele-technology. So there's telemedicine, tele-education. There's a lot of us who are really looking at trying to figure out how to harness that technology so we can leverage our resources even more effectively to back our partners as they build their system. And I think with this goes that, coming back to the social entrepreneurism component, looking at United States emergency care in the last 50 to 60 years, emergency care grew out of nothing. 80% of our hospitalizations come through the emergency department. I saw a figure of $107 billion in services are provided through emergency care within the United States. And this has been mostly done in a relatively capitalistic way. In a place with much higher levels of social cohesion, it stands to reason that if we really articulate how, if there's going to be a private sector, how it could be socially entrepreneuristic, how a certain percentage of revenue could go back to capacity development instead of just into investors' pockets, it might actually have more return on investment than it would in those people's pockets, in those few people's pockets. And so being mindful about potentially pushing in that direction for those of us who are trying to figure out the financing and growth of emergency care, not just the educational component, the training, and then the logistics of service delivery.
I might want to add again, you did mention about mentorship as well as getting a movement to support. And something came to mind around preparing potential partners who want to come and to join the process, yes, in terms of preparing them on what to expect, mm-hmm. as well as expectations. Yeah, so it's expectation management one, as well as
incredibly important.
Yeah, expectation
on both ends.
Yes, on both ends, because a lot of people come to support and have all these expectations of what they would want the system to look like, which I think is a very big expectation. What you expect to find is one thing, and then what they expect to actually do. And it gets more complex because it's a very short time. I'm going to come to Uganda for a week, and I want to train.
Or even a month. A month is even borderline too short.
Yeah. So they come. People come with good intentions for 1 week to change the way emergency care is delivered in Uganda. I know it's a big expectation. So the expectation on us as a system that is evolving gradually is very big, and sometimes becomes a burden on us. So every time there's a visiting team, you have to do a lot of buffering, if you know what I mean. I say, I'm going to take, I meet students, they come. I'm going to take you to the ward, but bear with us. We do not intentionally not intubate everyone because the factors are like this. It's not that we don't care, but it's because the system is so.
And actually, us working towards building a hub for education and research innovation at U of A, which is something some of us are working on, will actually do just that. It'll help prepare folks. It'll help them. It'll help ensure that faculty, students, and trainees are going over with the appropriate level of cultural humility, which needs to be huge. I don't think most will realize that they will learn more from our Ugandan colleagues than they will be teaching. And I think with that proper orientation, it provides for much more productive relationships and effect.
Yeah, I think that, you mentioned that you're trying to create an infrastructure. And if you have different teams that say, well, this is how we do things in Boston, this is how we do things in Seattle, this is how we do things in Oklahoma, this is how we do things in Spain, this is how we do things in China, wherever you're coming from, and you are, you personally are trying to arrange this system in your country, and you have too many cooks in the kitchen, everyone trying to teach a different way to do things, I can see how that can be disruptive. If you're going from, instead of just damage control, which I think a lot of us have that perception of, they just need all the help that they can get, and so I will just show up and give all the help that I know how to. And that's a big difference between that and going over and saying, I am here to help, use me as you need me, just let me know how I can be useful. All of us that are listening have been medical students or nursing students at some level, and you just wanted to be useful. You hated to stand there, especially if you're, I personally abhorred my surgery rotation because I hated standing there completely sterile, not able to move my hands above my shoulders or below my waist. And it drove me crazy because I just wanted to be useful. And I think that if I can kind of summarize that from what we've talked about, there's a need for this infrastructure, for the definition of emergency care in a lot of developing countries. And as that's being determined in those countries, the best way that we can be impactful is to support that growing infrastructure. So for anyone that's planning on going over to any place doing any kind of international medicine, please do. It's helpful, but go with the intention of being used by the group there that's doing the most good in the place where they are, where they live, so that it can be sustainable. And you don't have the experience of, well, that meant a lot to me, I wonder what it meant to the people I was there with.
And there are faculty around the different universities in the States and even Canada who are helping work on these areas. There's a growing group of us who have a very much of a shared mindset in this. There are also several organizations. Global Emergency Care is just one. So if you have any questions, please reach out. We're at www.globalemergencycare.org. You can also find us on Facebook, Twitter, etc. Or check out your local emergency medicine faculty members and see if anybody has any other useful opportunities for you.
All right. Well, thank you both very much for your collaboration and for being on this podcast with us.
I just really want to thank Dr. Kalonzi, as well as our other collaborators, for the patience it's taken with us from the outside to come in and work with us and help us develop our systems to be useful to them over the long term. It's been an unbelievable pleasure. I feel like we are now lifelong colleagues, and I really hope that our fellow faculty members and students get to find those same relationships, because that's what makes slaving away at nights for 8 to 10 nights in a row here in the United States absolutely worth it, because I get to do this.
Brad takes my sign out on a regular basis, so.
I won't make any comments about the quality of your sign out.
I would really appreciate it if you didn't.
Yeah. Again, thank you very much for hosting us, and thank you for expressing the interest to actually join us in this work. I'm sure as we're going through having a discussion around being national, being more national and less global, or being global but being national, you know.
Global is local, though.
Global is local.
Yes, no, it is absolutely true.
Exactly.
So another podcast.
Yeah. But yes, I would like to say thank you for that that kindness, a big heart to join our work. And I think from my perspective, it's actually going to be a learning experience, especially in terms of new approaches to doing things. If you look at, as I mentioned, I was thinking the other day that I've probably ordered for about 2 CT scans in my career. I've not worked for long. I've worked for about 8 years. But I've ordered for 2 CT scans, and I've managed up to about 3,000 patients. I ordered for 3 CT scans. My mortality from trauma is probably less than 4. Meaning, there are ways in which we do things that you can learn from, right? I discharge a patient, and the only thing, if at all, I would have asked her maybe to buy a catheter. And she's going to walk away, and she's spent in the equivalent of $2, right? And she's been admitted for 48 hours on my ward. Compared to your side, where you might, a different context, but you might, I don't know how much it's going to work out of after all the tests and all. So there are things that you can learn. So our area is a learning, it's a learning environment, which I think would benefit us all. You come and learn, we can teach you how to do some things, and then, yeah.
I just want to reiterate that you work in an emergency department with 3 doctors in 50 beds for 8 years and have ordered 2 CT scans and have a very low mortality rate, just so that gets out there to the listeners that you actually can practice clinical medicine and be good at it.
Dr. Williams here. I'm an emergency practitioner at the University of Arizona.
How are you?
Hi. I teach some wilderness medicine and a lot of wilderness medicine education. I was asked to do peer review for this discussion between Brad Dreyfuss and Dr. Colanzi, which I thought was an excellent introduction to some of the challenges in global care, particularly in Uganda, sub-Saharan Africa. And how about Dr. Colanzi? He sounds amazing and kind of an inspiration, honestly. Brad did an excellent job of introducing Dr. Colanzi to our area of the sphere here, and I've just triggered a bunch of flat earthers. But I really thought that the discussion could have gotten a little bit deeper, and that's honestly no criticism, really. It's just a function of the time constraints that they had. But a couple things I would have liked to see expanded was what the locals in Uganda and the local physicians in Uganda and the government in Uganda view as emergency care, and kind of break that down into the disparities there. I'm sure that the physicians there understand to a greater degree what emergency care is as we would see it. But I really thought it would be interesting to hear what the locals would view, because as Brad Dreyfuss mentioned, it's not just a matter of medical expectations, but cultural expectations. So I'd be curious what the local culture would view as emergency care, and then the government. And there's got to be a discrepancy or disparity between the government's point of view of what emergency care should be or would look like relative to the physicians and the locals. And we see that here in the United States as well. You know, another thing is a little bit of what I would call Brad Dreyfuss's kind of global speak. And that's just because he's in that milieu, and he uses a lot of terms and verbiage that kind of goes over my head or seems sometimes platitudinous. But, you know, for example, things like vertical versus horizontal programs, siloed programs. And by the way, just if I can say one more thing about Brad Dreyfuss, I think an excellent drinking game would be that every time Brad says the word leverage or leveraging, you take a shot, and everyone's going to be wasted by the end of this podcast, I'm pretty sure. So I know as a peer review, I'm supposed to be a little bit critical. I'm on the other end of the microphone, as it were, compared to usual this time, and so I'd like to be critical without being hypocritical. But to be honest, there's not a lot to criticize about this discussion other than one thing I'm going to get to here in a second. It's not that much of a criticism, more of a clarification or just a defense of medical tourism. And I'll get to that in a minute. But I think there's a lot we can learn from the situation in sub-Saharan Africa, particularly in Uganda. As Dr. Kalonzi mentioned, this is going to require a complete paradigm shift. And as he mentioned, there's a lot that people who go to Uganda to volunteer can actually learn from them about how to better provide care in our country. I had mentioned before about the idea of how patients or locals view emergency care, how that can influence the emergency care system. And it got me thinking, you know, we can see the same, and we are seeing the same thing here in our emergency departments. If there's a disconnect between what we have traditionally viewed as emergency medicine and what our patients view as an emergency medicine, inevitably the system of emergency medicine is going to adapt more to accommodate the patient. So if, for example, if patients are continually viewing urgent care as appropriate emergency presentations, then emergency departments are going to adapt. And that's almost entirely a financial and pragmatic adaptation. And we are seeing that throughout the country as emergency departments are starting to incorporate more and more fast-track and mid-level providers to accommodate the influx of patients presenting for urgent care complaints. Well, in sub-Saharan Africa, I'm not so sure it's all urgent care. And as Dr. Kalonzi referenced, they apparently have a tremendous amount of acuity there. But can you imagine a hospital system or emergency system where you're dealing with a large degree of urgent care, emergency resuscitative care, trauma care? How do you adapt? And importantly, how do payers adapt? Are they going to continue to pay emergency compensation for an influx of urgent care from the same provider who's providing resuscitative ICU level care or trauma care? I think that's on the horizon. That's going to have to change. It's inevitably going to change. For those who have some knowledge or understanding of the differences between the American, the Anglo, and the Franco models of emergency care, particularly in EMS care, I think that puts Africa actually in a kind of an exciting position to analyze all of the different systems that currently exist and study them and actually find what works better. We have a scoop and run model, and many places are a stay and play model. And there are reasons that those sometimes work in one location better than another, but I don't think that they are adequately analyzed or scientifically researched to determine what model may actually be better in what situation. And Africa is has a perfect opportunity to research that prior to implementation and proceed more methodically. Another way that sub-Saharan Africa may be on the forefront of research that could eventually apply to our system here is the concept of task shifting and task sharing. We're already seeing it with mid-levels, of course. I think it's pretty clear that lessons are being learned as the world has tried to assist Africa in rising out of poverty and in providing medical care for its people. And we're learning maybe the principle of teaching one to fish rather than providing fish. And Dr. Kalonzi referenced how Uganda in many ways can become a dumping ground for things and stuff. Many of us have heard of instances where companies have provided an MRI machine or a CT scanner without providing technicians or education to repair it, and they're in disrepair within a year. And you'll find clinics with broken MRI machines and broken CT scanners that are unable to be used. That provides very, very little benefits to the people, pharmaceuticals that are way beyond expired. And Brad referenced the negative effects of creating a system whereby others are dependent on you, and is an overabundance of charity or welfare actually harmful or weakening, dare I say, enslaving. That's an excellent point, Brad. And, you know, it's a valid argument against an overly expanded welfare systems in general. The last and really only point of clarification or criticism that I want to provide has to do with the concept of medical tourism. Aaron talked about the time that he went to visit Guatemala and left that feeling affected and inadequate. Brad commented on how rather than spending $4,000 on a medical trip where you feel like you're providing something, but really you're just there, could be better spent by donating that money to an organization that already has an infrastructure in place to make better use of that money. I understand exactly what Brad's saying there, and there is something to be said for making smart financial investments with money when it comes to charity. And I would urge everybody to, if you're providing to a charity, try and understand how many cents of every dollar goes to the actual provision of charitable care and not just to overhead. And many charities actually separate the two completely, and they will do fundraisers to actually support their operations and overhead that are separate from the charities that otherwise they otherwise receive. Look for those kinds of organizations. I think another situation in which it is very important to not simply show up and try and help is a disaster relief situation. And that's a situation where you can actually not only not help much, but actually increase the burden in those situations. And so what I'm about to say does not apply to either of those situations. But I think there needs to be a little bit of defense for medical tourism. It's clear that Aaron was affected by that trip to Guatemala, and that changed him and honestly led to further contributions in the forms of charity and giving. When I teach my Introduction to Wilderness Medicine course, I start with a picture of a tree in a very small town called Bwindi in Uganda. I visited Uganda in 2013 purely as a tourist, and I went to see the highland gorillas in the impenetrable forest. And while we were in the town of Bwindi the day prior to our trip, we walked around the town and ended up doing a tour that involved a tour of the hospital. They took us to this tree in the middle of the town and said, "This is where Dr. Kellerman formed the hospital." And I asked more about Dr. Kellerman's story. Dr. Kellerman, in year 2000, went as a tourist, purely as a tourist, to see the same gorillas that I was seeing. Over his time as a tourist, Dr. Kellerman grew to appreciate the Ugandan people, and particularly the local pygmy tribe called the Batwa people, and recognized an opportunity to serve, to help. And he asked where a good location that everyone would recognize would be, so that when he returned in months, that he could set up a clinic there. And they pointed to a very large tree in the center of the town and said, "If you tell everyone to meet there on a certain day, then we will make sure that you have patients." And he showed up and was able to provide a significant amount of health care, but then had to leave, again talking about the inability to maintain a lasting care. But over years, he was able to extend the length of the clinic from a couple weeks to a few months to incorporate other services such as orthopedics and OB care, and over years has increased the clinic to now a hospital that has moved a little bit further away from the tree because it's grown so large. They have an ambulance that is able to do some extractions. And now the Kellerman Foundation provides year-round care at the Bwindi Community Hospital and now incorporates a nursing school. As a shoot-off of the medical services that he provided there and the funds that he was able to amass, they have created a local school. So education, general education, has also increased in the area. And my point here is that all of this was bootstrapped from mere tourism. And so I don't disparage anyone for using CME money to go on a medical mission or taking a little bit of time off to provide a little bit of care, because it changes them. And that change can be lasting and lead to much greater good than simply putting a check in the mail is. There's a principle in charity where the greater the distance between the giver and the receiver, the less benefit it has. On a humanitarian or spiritual or emotional level, it dehumanizes the act, and it robs both the giver and the receiver of the love and appreciation that charity should engender. No one feels very charitable and grateful on tax day, for example. And I know that Brad would agree with that. I'm not saying that Brad states otherwise. I just think that defense of the benefits of tourism and of medical volunteerism just needed to be stated. And again, I applaud Dr. Kalonzi. He stated something that actually hit me. He said that those providers of emergency care in developing nations all around the world proceed in faith. He is a pioneer proceeding in faith. And for us, a lot of that faith in becoming a doctor and providing care for our patients was kind of taken out because we plugged ourselves into a medical system whereby if we simply show up to class, pass the tests, at the end of the pathway, we are physicians, and there's a system already there. As Brad mentioned, the pathway is already illuminated. That's not the case in developing countries, and to be a part of developing that new system of emergency care in the dark requires proceeding with a great degree of faith and hope that that you're going to succeed. And that's adventurous and that's exciting. And so hopefully this has inspired people to get into providing international care, recognizing the benefits of providing care in austere situations, how that can make you a better clinician here in the States, even in a system as built up as ours.